Coke session number 13273, reel 2.
Well, we got this interference and we assumed, rightly or wrongly, I don't know to this day if it was right or wrong, it came from naval ships, electrical gubbins, or possibly their own naval radar. And we found that we could home onto convoys, or it helped to home onto convoys, to use this electrical interference.
Did you ever get any VIPs come round to investigate how you were getting on?
Only one, and a very, very notable one. One day, Sir Henry Tizard came round. And I think to this day, I've never been in the presence of a mind which so impressed me. I'm very surprised that I even came face to face with him, because I was a very junior acting pilot officer, or possibly a pilot officer by then. And he went and saw the CO, a chap called Tim Vickers, who I still see, a nice chap. And he went and saw the CO and all the brass. And then he asked Tim, he said, I'd like to talk to the pilots who do the most flying. And this was always Eric Starling or myself and one or two others, Jack Hoskins, a sergeant pilot. So he spoke to a group of pilots, regardless of rank, merely because they had done the most flying. And Sir Henry Tizard, an ex-pilot himself, so he puts a practical aspect onto all his inquiries. So we always saw the great man, and he immediately asked, he said, well, how many U-boats has the squadron found? And it was a very, very small number, perhaps one or two, only. And he said, and did you find those on your ASV? We said, no. He said, well, maybe I should take the... It's a clumsy thing. It adds to your burdens, adds to the burdens of your crew. Perhaps we should take it out. And we all said, no, God heavens, no. He said, well, why not? With an absolute innocent look. And in no time, he started telling me all the uses we'd found for ASV. How to find Tory Island, how to find Northern Ireland, how to do our letdown procedures, how to find the convoys. And he just listened with a smile on his face, just by saying, "Well, I suppose you want me to take it out." He dragged every piece of information that we'd found out about ASV, and he's the kind of man where you start a sentence and he'll finish it for you, or else he will express the thought you're trying to say in a far better way, in far fewer words than what you're trying to say. Occasionally you meet a mind that is so light years ahead of your own, it's just a great pleasure to be in his presence. And that's my... And that was Sir Henry Tizard.
That was presumably at Limavady.
At Limavady.
Which month might that have been, do you think?
I suppose we're in 40... We moved there about April. March or April, could be about June, I suppose, somewhere around about there.
What did the ASV apparatus in the plane look like?
It was about a foot high, about 5 inches wide, and it had a line down the middle. And it was a very, very elementary form of... Well, it was a cathode ray tube of a modern television set. And when you found an object, it came a blip on this line, and you had three scales. You had an 80-mile scale, a 10-mile scale, I think a 40-mile scale. Not that you could ever find anything at 80 miles other than Northern Ireland. And the idea was you could shift the scales. And this blip would be one side or another side of the center line. And that meant to say that you have a blip if it was on the right of the center line. There's a blip, you know, be it a ship, a Northern Ireland, an island, or anything else, to your right. So you turned the aircraft to the right until it became dead center, so it was equidistant either side, and the whole thing was only 1/8 of an inch long, or 1/16 of an inch long nearly, and you got endless interference and sea returns jumping up and down. It was a tremendously difficult job to interpret. We all had a go, and you flew towards this blip on the center line, and it just gradually came down the scale. And if you found it, say, you know, 10 miles, if you flew towards it gradually, if you found it at, say, 20 miles, you flew towards it until it came down to 10, then you shifted to the 10-mile scale and came down around about 3 or 4 miles over the Atlantic. It would disappear in the sea returns. And this is why you couldn't find a U-boat with it, because it around about 3 or 4 miles, the sea returns occupied the last 3 or 4 miles of the scale.
You painted a rather dark picture about the fact of not finding U-boats, but presumably the very presence of your squadron doing this work might well have kept U-boats down and made their job a lot more difficult.
Yes. Yes, undoubtedly. I know some post-war studies or late-war studies were done between aircraft and U-boats, and with our submarines and our aircraft, and on the whole, our submarines found the aircraft about 4 times before the aircraft found the submarine. In other words, you got, especially the German U-boats with a highly trained crews, you had 4 people standing there in the conning tower, each covering 1 quadrant of the horizon, with very high-powered glasses on. It's a very good German optical glasses. You had 4 people standing there on about 2 hours shifts, just scanning the sky with glasses. I mean, you know, we didn't even have glasses, we just had our eyesight. And of course, you're flying the aircraft looking through a windscreen. They found us far more often. I'm quite sure that we may, of course, are the odd one to dive.
Now, can we go on to how later in 1941 you went to Malta, please?
Yes, it was quite a surprise. I suppose it was a month or so after Sir Henry had visited us. The CO sent for me, and I think I'd probably done as much flying. I think, say, either Jack Hoskins, Eric, or I had done more flying than anybody else. And he sent for me and said, "Would you be interested in taking your crew to Malta?" Well, I wasn't doing anything very useful, and I suppose I've always been quite responsive to challenges, and I suppose I said, "Well, that's all right, sir. When do we go?" And he said, "Well, I'll let you know." And in due course, he rather insulted my crew. He said, "Look here, you've only got a crew of sergeants and flight sergeants. Would you like me to strengthen your crew by giving you another officer?" And I said, "Good heavens, no, sir! I got the best crew in the world." As I fondly imagined I had by then. I was very insulted. So in due course, we went and picked up a new aircraft at the same type, Wellington 8. A Wellington 8 is a Wellington 1C, which is a Wellington with Pegasus engines. It's a Pegasus engine Wellington with ASV, and then it becomes an 8. So we picked up this new aircraft, and we flew it to St. Evel in Cornwall, and I think we may have spent a night or two there. And we loaded it up. When I say we loaded it up, we sure loaded it up. Chiefy Wavell had a huge stock of books he decided to take with him. I had a couple of puppies which we decided to take. Don't ask me why. I don't think I knew what else to do with them. And we took off from St. Neville. It'd be August, a very hot August day. And we had full tanks to go to Gibraltar. We also thought we might, with luck, find a U-boat on the way. So we put on a maximum load of depth charges. In fact, we took off about 100 yards past the end of the runway off a taxi track in the end because of the weather and the overweight of the aircraft. Anyhow, we took off and we got to Gibraltar all right. There were 3 of us. There was a flight lieutenant, a regular, who'd been promoted to squadron leader to would take charge of the flight, a chap I never spoke a word to before. And there was a fairly senior flying officer, also a regular, who I also hadn't spoken to before, and myself and our crews. And we all got to Gibraltar safely. Not an easy task, I might say. Gibraltar then had a very, very short runway with some very tricky winds, and one sight of Gibraltar showed all the wrecked aircraft which hadn't made it alongside the runway. Anyhow, we were all experienced pilots, and we got in Gibraltar, and we probably spent a night or two there, and then we just flew to Malta in very loose formation, about 100 yards apart. We put guns, we armed the thing up in case again we found a U-boat. We did spot one Italian float plane on the way, but it wasn't interested in us, and we were only interested in Malta, in getting to Malta. We arrived there, as all aircraft did arrive there at night, and the first thing, of course, we're now flying over the calm Mediterranean, early September, not a ripple. As a result, the radar, which we had on board, the same ASV, picked up the island of Malta at about 80 miles range. Now, we'd never picked up Northern Ireland more than about 40 miles before, 40 or 50 miles at the most. So in the dry air of the Mediterranean, which we didn't realize that ASV liked dry air then, and the calm sea, we now knew we had a radar set, airborne radar set, that really was efficient. So anyhow, it was a great help to pick up Malta at 80 miles, and we landed safely and settled ourselves in, our three crews. At that time, Malta was not being very heavily bombed. It had been heavily bombed up to about June 1941. Then the Luftwaffe went off to fight Russia, and it was during the lull when Malta was having only the Italian Air Force to compete with, and Malta could cope with the Italian Air Force far better than the Luftwaffe. So we assumed, or I assumed, after all, so no one told me, I was just the junior of the three, and no one told me what we were supposed to do, but I assumed we'd gone there to look for U-boats, because that's what we had been looking for in the Atlantic. But it wasn't so at all. We'd gone there to find convoys. I'm sure it all goes back to Sir Henry Tizard's visit, when we said we could find convoys. He said, well, of course, where would aircraft to find convoys be of most use? And of course, that was in the Mediterranean, where Rommel was and his Africa Corps and the Italian armies were in North Africa, when the supplies were in Italy, and he had to be fed with ships and convoy which went from Sicily or Italy to North Africa. And that was our job, to pick up convoys going to North Africa. And we weren't supposed to attack them, although that came later perhaps. We weren't supposed to attack them. We were supposed to act as a night reconnaissance and report them. And it was up to others to attack them. We had a very good daylight recce squadron in Malta, which was keeping a very good tabs on the convoys in daylight, and we would do this job at night.
And you were called the Special Duties Flight?
We were called the Special Duties Flight, or SDF for short. Naturally, our aircraft, perhaps I should go back and explain, this early form of radar had aerials all over the place. We had vast array of aerials under the wings. We had aerials down the side of the aircraft. We had huge aerials all up and down the spine of the aircraft. We were massive aerials to pick up the all orders to transmit and receive on the radar. And naturally, Malta had never seen anything like this before. And I must emphasize, it was still top secret. We were told under no circumstances were we to talk about it. No circumstances could we use the initials ASV ever. And naturally, everyone was very curious to know what these very strange-looking Wellingtons were doing. And for some extraordinary reason, we became known as Goofingtons. Don't ask me why. some called us sticklebacks, which was far more appropriate. We were known as Goofingtons. And so I was told to go out and find a convoy somewhere, and I went out, I think I found it, and then I was told to press down my key so that some bomber command Wellingtons could home on to me, you know, press down my radio key, wireless key, it was called. And they tried to attack it, but I mean, bombing ships at night from a high level is extremely optimistic. And this went on for a night or two, and then there came the night that changed my life, completely and utterly changed my life. I'd been operating, I think, 3 nights out of 4, and I came back in extremely bad weather. We had no sophisticated letdown aids, because they didn't exist then. But at least I had my radar, I could find the island. I came back somewhere around about, I don't know, about 5 in the morning. Not quite light. It would be about 5 in the morning. I'd been out for about 10 hours. It was absolutely pouring with rain. I had, the cloud base was, I don't know, a couple of 100 feet or something quite low. And it's a very poor runway at Lucca then, and it was very poorly illuminated owing to the fact that it was always liable to be a night raid. Anyhow, I was quite pleased to get down safely. I was a bit tired and wet, and I have, you know, with my blue eyes, it's quite normal. Night adaption is very bad for people with blue eyes. It's very good after you. My night vision is very good, but the adaption is bad. And it takes me, a few minutes. I walk into ops room where they have lights on. I couldn't see very well for a minute or two. And someone said, "Well, this is Spooner, sir." And I found myself looking at an Air Vice Marshal. Well, I'd never seen anybody higher than a group captain before, and I'd been in the war, been going nearly 2 years. They had been going 2 years. Never seen anybody higher than a group captain. And I imagine that Air Marshals were some aloof people who sat in offices miles from anywhere and told people to go and fight. And it was a big surprise to me to find on a horrible wet morning at 5 in the morning an air marshal in ops room. This was not my idea of air marshals at all. So he sort of stepped forward, and his first words I always remember endeared me. He said, I've been watching the weather, Spooner. He said, you did well to get down in this bad weather. I thought, God, here's an air marshal who even understands something about bad weather flying. I am in luck. So he listened while I got debriefed. Then when it was all over, he said, "Now," I said, "you were flying last night, weren't you?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "And the night before?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Aren't there 3 of you? I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, what are the others doing?" Well, what could I say? I don't think I said anything, but I think my expression probably said it for me. So he said, He said, "All right, Spooner." He said, "Now come and see me tomorrow." And he said, "By the way," he said, "a chap called Captain Agnew wants to see you." He said, "Go and see Captain Agnew tomorrow." I said, "Who's?" He said, "Captain Agnew." I said, "Well, who's? Where do I find him, sir?" He said, "Captain Agnew, Force K, HMS Aurora, down by the harbour. Go and see Captain Agnew tomorrow, and then come and see me." It was all machine gun talk. He talked like that. I was very tired and very wet, hungry, and everything else. So I went to bed.
And the name of this Air Vice Marshal?
Hugh Pugh Lloyd. Always known as Hugh Pugh. Some people call him Huey Pewey. But always known as Hugh Pugh by his rhyming surnames, H-U-G-H, P-U-G-H-E. That's why some people call him Huey Pewey, Hugh Pugh Lloyd, a marvelous man. So anyhow, events then tumbled over themselves in the most appalling manner, with appalling frequency, rather, wasn't appalling swiftness, I should have said. I got some sleep. Someone told me how to get to see Captain Agnew. Meanwhile, I think before I saw Captain Agnew, I'm not sure the actual order of things, someone came along to me next day and said, oh, by the way, there's a signal here. I said, yes. He said, you're promoted to flight lieutenant and you're put in charge of the flight. I said, I said, I'm a pilot officer. He said, you were a pilot officer. You're now a flight lieutenant and you are OC of the special duties flight. So I was a bit bewildered by all this. By the way, before he left, Hugh Pugh said to me, he said, you'll be seeing a lot of me in future. He said, get yourself a car. I didn't know where to get a car from. I had to backtrack a bit. We'd arrived in Malta with no maintenance, just three air crews. But there was a Bomber Command Wellington unit there. I think it was 38 Squadron, it might have been 40, it might have been 104. But there was a Bomber Command Wellington unit there. And because I had nothing to do with this, I was just a junior officer. But a chap called Flight Sergeant Dale had appeared from somewhere and was looking after our aircraft. And somewhere along the line, after Hugh Pugh said, get yourself a car, it was probably after a few days later, I spoke to Dale, Flight Sergeant Dale. I'd never spoken to him before, hardly, because, you know, he was the boss maintenance man, I was just a junior pilot. And I said, look, the AOC says I'm to get a car. Where do I get a car from? He said, the AOC said you get a car. He said, I'll get you a car. And he got me the second best car on the island. I don't know where he got it from. He got me a lovely American Plymouth. He must have said, well, the AOC wants this. So I had my Plymouth, and in due course I went down to the harbour steps, which I was told was the right place to do. I got some kind of transport, sea transport. Can't remember what it was at the moment. Perhaps I'd even made an appointment. Perhaps Captain Agnew had sent something for me. Details beyond me. But the interview is not beyond me. Anyhow, I found myself on board this naval cruiser, HMS Aurora, and I said I'd come to see Captain Agnew. Some naval chap said, you know, follow me, sir. He's expecting you. I don't know if you've ever been on board a naval cruiser, have you?
Yes.
Well, they shoot up and down metal vertical ladders, enormous rate of knots, because they're used to it. But this chap sort of shot down a metal ladder. I very tentatively followed him and knocked on the door and said, you know, a Flight Lieutenant Spooner, sir. Oh, I might even been a pilot officer still, I can't be sure. And I found myself into a room just as nicely furnished as this nearly. There were pictures of a family. There were, I'm not sure they were flowers, but they were almost chintz on the on the settee. And there was this lovely smiling chap called Captain Agnew. So he made me welcome, and it was tea time. And tea was served, and almost in china cups, I think. And we sat down and had a nice cup of tea in this, right in the midst of this steel ship, all these nice comforts around. And after we sipped tea, he said, tell me, Spooner, he said, I understand you've got an apparatus on board. Tell me what it'll do. Well, he's the first person to even ask me, but I felt all secrecy could be waived now. I told him what I thought he could do. He said, just a minute. He said, I'm not very technical. He said, do you mind if I get my radar officer to join us? you know, did I mind following naval captain? And I said, by all means. So naval, I think, lieutenant commander came along. I started all over again, and he asked a lot of questions, and the radar chap asked a lot of questions. And Captain Agnew said, that's very interesting. He said, now I'll tell you what I can do. And he said, I'm in commander of a force called Force K. We have two cruisers, HMS Aurora, this one, HMS Penelope, which is the twin sister. We're light cruisers of about 5,000 tons only. And We have two destroyers, HMS Lance, HMS Lively. They're very good destroyers. They're about 1,900 tons. And our job here is to sink the enemy ships at night. Now, what you've told me, you can find enemy ships at night, especially, as you say, in these calm waters of the Mediterranean. You think you might be able to find a convoy 20 or 30 miles. I said, I have been finding them at about, I think, a convoy I could probably find on a good night, as long as everything's working, I might well find a convoy 20 or 30 miles. He said, that's very interesting. He said, I am very restricted on what I'm allowed to do. Owing to the amount of bombing that goes on this island, I'm not allowed to leave harbour in daylight because there are too many dive bombers around the place. But I'm allowed to leave 1 hour before sunset, and I have to be back 1 hour after dawn. Now, this limits my radius of action very much. And I can't go out and look for ships just on the odd chance. I can only go out if I'm sure there's something there for me to attack. And he says, now, the enemy is going around a long way from Malta, because he doesn't like Malta very much. And if you can find them within my range, I think we may be able to, you know, go out and sink them. But, of course, you have to tell me where they are in the first place. You have to guide me to them. And he said, well, let's go away and think about this. Let's go and think if we can work out something. He said, I should tell you, he said, all about night fighting. First of all, I can tell you a little bit about night fighting. He said, you can regard us as one ship. He said, we sail and fight as one ship. We're always in the same order, Aurora, Lance, Penelope, Lively, and we steam in each other's wake. So you can regard us as one ship. He said, we do that in case we get mixed up with a night engagement. So we'll always know where we are relative. He said, if we run into ships at night, he said, the history of night fighting of ships is confusion. If ships are all over the place, you never know if you're firing at your own ship or anybody else's very often. But we fight as one ship. And we go at 28 knots, and we can leave 1 hour before sunset, and we have to be back 1 hour after dawn. So that gives us a radius of action of, he gave me, you know, he sort of gave me the distance. He said, well, let's go back, he said, think of what I've told you. We'll be thinking of what you told me, and we'll meet again in a few days' time. And somewhere along the line, I then was introduced or met this brilliant Canadian ground radar officer, Al Glazer, and he got in the act too. And to this day, I don't know how we worked it out, but over a series of meetings, we worked out a procedure in which I would find ships at night and would guide him onto them. And it worked like a charm. And the whole secret of it was that Al Glazer put a radio beacon, which he had to make out of a spare IFF set, because he hadn't got the equipment available in Malta, out of a spare IFF set, he made a radio beacon and put it on Aurora's masthead. And I could find that over the top of the scale. Over 100 miles, it came out of the blip the whole way across the screen. So I could find Agnew, enormous range, in a very, very distinctive form. I could never muddle him up with anybody else at all. And this was tremendous, because I now... Then we worked out... I had a discussion with Captain Agnew and his navigator chief one day. And he said, now, how accurate is your navigation? I said, it's not accurate. I said, we have no accurate met. We do our best. We make our own met. We drop